Switch on, please. Excuse me. All right. We have an answer for the delta G of -107.0 kilojoules. And then if we would have gone through and calculated K, the equilibrium constant, we would have come up with 5.7 times 10 to the 18th. Now the question on this one here was to tell whether or not the process was spontaneous or not. Is this a spontaneous process?
Yes.
Yes, it is. Why is it spontaneous? Delta G is less than zero. Delta G is negative. So this is a spontaneous process. We had not asked that earlier here, but when we did our combustion reaction, we saw another case here of a negative delta G. So this process here must be spontaneous as well. Now the relation that I'd like to make here, first of all, is twofold. First portion of this is that when we calculate the equilibrium constant K, you might notice that I rounded off here to just two significant figures. I might argue that we might really only have one significant figure in this because of the way how anti-logs work. And so let me remind you that if we had something like if we calculated the pH, you know, something like 10 raised to the negative 11.52 power, and we wanted to derive the hydronium ion concentration from this. If we had a pH of 11.52, how many significant figures should be in the hydronium ion concentration? Just two. We simply count the two digits after the decimal as significant figures when we deal with the pHs. And we said that this here, the numbers in front of the decimal, indicate to us the power of 10. Well, this here is a base 10 anti-logarithm. E is a base E, or natural logarithms. And so by the same argument here, when we take and raise it to power, typically the numbers in front of the decimal do not indicate for us significant figures. It's really only the digits after the decimal that would count as significant figures. And so if we have three significant figures up in this calculation, that means that this whole value, what I calculated out, has a value of 43.1822, etc. So the three significant figures would take it out to here, and so maybe we'd only expect one out here in the result. And so you'd see here, if you did do some rounding, you'd wind up with some varied answers out here. And so the point I'm trying to make on this is that if you do get an answer that's very different on these equilibrium constants from the back of the book, it's probably due to the fact that you or perhaps the textbook has done some rounding. And typically an equilibrium constant like this would probably only be calculated by with one significant figure. When I set this up in D2L, I believe I set it up with a wide enough tolerance. If you are calculating equilibrium constants both here in chapter 19 and chapter 20, and you get it marked wrong and you feel you have it right, let me know. Because once again, it could be that I just did not set the tolerance large enough to accept a wide enough range of answers due to how rounding can affect these calculated results. Secondly, let's look at what this value means. Remember now, if we're talking about a large equilibrium constant, this would be a large value of K. And if we have a large value of K, that is a large equilibrium constant, what does that mean about the amount of products versus the amount of reactants? Lots of products. It means lots of products. Because remember that the way the equilibrium constant is calculated is by taking products over reactants. And so if we wind up with a very big value, that means we have lots of products and very little reactants. When we dealt with equilibrium constants, we would have said that this was a product-favored reaction. And if we found one that had a small equilibrium constant, we would have said that is one that is reactant-favored. Now, it turns out here we've shown this a couple reasons, or a couple different ways. Large K, again, means product-favored. And product-favored is the same thing as saying that the process is spontaneous. Because if it's product favored, that means it goes to products. And saying it's spontaneous means it goes to products. And if we said that a process is reacting favored, that means that there's pretty much no reaction. There's very few products. And another way we've said that is that the process is non-spontaneous. So a non-spontaneous process and reactive favored are the same thing, and a spontaneous process and product favored are the same thing. Okay, so I did tell you that we would be tying together a few concepts here in chapter 19 and 20. There is one tie-in. Now, here's another tie-in, and all I've done, you don't need to rewrite this, you already have this written somewhere in your notes. I'm just rewriting it here to keep this down, but we did say here now that a process is spontaneous if delta G is less than zero. Process is non-spontaneous if it's delta G is greater than zero. And if delta G is about zero, then we call it an equilibrium process. And in your text, you have a table that appears on page 790. Page 790. I'm just going to rewrite it up here. You don't need to rewrite it, but ones in which we look at the sign of delta H and delta S and our interpretation of this. And so now the possible values that we could have here would be where the two signs are, in the one case, delta H being negative and delta S being positive. One in which delta H is positive and delta S is negative. We could have a case where they are both positive. We could have a case where both of these are negative. And again, this is all on page 790. So now, the first two cases ought to be the easiest interpretation. And by interpretation, we want to know, is it spontaneous? Spontaneous or not? And so, let's say we have a negative value for delta H and a positive value for delta S. Delta H is negative, delta S is positive. If delta H is negative, delta S is positive, we have a negative value minus a positive value. And if we have a negative value minus a positive value, we'll wind up with a value that is negative. And if we wind up with a negative value for this, that means that delta G is negative. If delta G is negative, that must mean that the process is spontaneous. And so this goes back to the question yesterday, is the reaction entropy driven or is it enthalpy driven? If we had a case where delta H is positive and delta S is negative, we'd have a positive value minus a negative value. A positive value minus a negative value is going to give us one that is positive. And if we have a positive value for delta G, that would be a case for non-spontaneous. It's when the two signs are the same that we have to give a little bit more careful consideration to this. If we have a positive value minus a positive value, a positive minus a positive could in some cases be a positive value, and in some cases it could be a negative value. And so the ultimate determining factor whether it's positive or negative is going to be the size of T. And so if we have a positive minus a positive, what would T need to be, relatively speaking, in order for this entire quantity to be negative? Positive minus positive. T would have to be a big value in order to make this quantity negative. And so what we'd say is that this is spontaneous at relatively large T. And again, we use the term relatively because in one reaction, a relatively large temperature might be room temperature, like it was yesterday with our endothermic reaction. In other cases, relatively high temperature might be 4,000 K. So it's one in which it is relative. It depends upon the reaction. Well, then if we have a case where they're both negative, that would give us a negative minus a negative. And if we have a negative minus a negative, in order for this entire result to be negative, then T must be one that is relatively small. Because a negative number minus a relatively small negative number will still keep this value negative. So we would say that this one here is spontaneous at relatively small or low temperatures. Any questions on that portion? Again, it's important that we realize that we're talking about these as being relative amounts. What's relatively high in one case may not be in another. What's relatively low in one case may not be relatively low in another case. Finally, the last piece here is going to be a way that we can approximate of the standard free energy change which I'll put in quotes, the standard free energy change where everything else is standard, except the temperature. And so a way that we may calculate that would be a delta G sub T is equal to delta H under standard conditions minus T delta S. And so this here would give us an approximation of the free energy change at some other temperature. Now, one of the applications of this may be to help tell us this thing as well. What are these relatively high temperatures, or what are these relatively low temperatures at which the process goes from being spontaneous to non-spontaneous? And so what we're going to do here is we're going to look at an example of this, and this will come from the end of chapter 19. And we're going to look at number 63. Now, you can write these numbers down if you'd like. Otherwise, you can follow along on here. I think what's going to be most important is how we use our delta H and delta S's. And so I'm going to compute these rather quickly. We have sodium bicarbonate, which decomposes to yield sodium carbonate, solid, plus water in the gaseous phase, plus some CO2 in the gaseous phase. And again, this decomposition occurs when we heat sodium bicarbonate. And so typically, we put a delta above the symbol to indicate that this is upon heating. Now, let me tell you that I actually have some experience with this reaction on a couple of counts. It's a very useful reaction for extinguishing fires. And back when I was in college, I came home over break, loaded up the wood stove because it was cold. And what happened is I loaded it up way too much with some tiny pieces of wood and caused the chimney to start on fire, And so we had a chimney fire because there was a bunch of creosote in there. And so the quickest way to put out that fire was I took a box of baking soda and I threw the box of baking soda into the wood stove. Well, why did I do that? Well, the wood stove was really hot, and so it causes it to decompose and produces carbon dioxide. And the carbon dioxide extinguishes fires. And so it's a very quick, effective way to put out the fire. So we can, however, calculate what that temperature would be. And to do this, I'm going to go ahead and write down the standard entropies of formation and the standard enthalpies of formation. And these values I have already looked up. For the delta H's, we've got negative 950.8. We have negative 1130.8. We've got 241.8 and negative 393.5. And for the standard entropies, we have a value of 101.7, 138.8, 188.7, and 213.7. And of course, these are given in units of kilojoules per mole for the delta H's and joules per mole dot K for the entropies. And then it looks like we're going to have all of these as one mole, except for I did make one mistake in my balanced chemical equation, and that should be a 2 out front. And so that means we're going to have to take 2 times these here. And so if we were to go ahead and calculate the standard enthalpy change for this reaction, the standard enthalpy change for this reaction would be equal to the sum of the products, which would be the negative 1130.8 plus, oops, and I missed the sign here, it's a negative 241 and plus a negative 393.5 minus the sum of the reactants, which is going to be 2 times the negative 950.8. Blah, blah, blah. I don't know what blah, 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 blah is all about, but all right, we get 135.5. Label on this is going to be kilojoules. And then if we calculate the delta S, under standard thermodynamic conditions, looks like we could sum together the 138.8, the 188.7, the 213.7, subtract from it the sum for the reactants, which is the 101.7, get a positive 337.8. Label on this is joules per Kelvin.
Now, what this particular question asked for us to do, it asked for us to estimate the temperature at which the sodium bicarbonate decomposes. And if we look at this, first of all,
we have a case where delta H is positive. We have a case where delta S is positive. If delta H and delta S are both positive, that means that this reaction will be spontaneous only at temperatures that are relatively high.
And so that's why, again, we talked about having to heat this in order to cause this reaction. Well, to estimate that temperature, we come back here and we have our equation, delta G sub T is equal to the standard enthalpy change minus T delta S. If we want to estimate the temperature which it decomposes, what that means is that the sign on delta G is going to change. And that is at standard temperature, with the signs both being positive, we would guess that probably the sign on delta G is negative if we have to heat it. And so, what we want to look at is you want to look at the point at which delta G changes over from a positive number over to where it becomes a negative number. And the place where we change from a positive number to a negative number is at a value of zero. And so we're going to say then that this is going to be equal to zero, because again, that is the point at which this reaction is going to become spontaneous. Because if it is non-spontaneous, we want to make it spontaneous, then at that point where it changes from a positive sign to a negative sign, that value is going to be zero. So we then set this equal to zero. We have this as being delta H minus T delta S. And don't forget the superscripts there. We're going to add a T delta S to each side. And then divide each side by delta S. Divide each side by delta S, then we find out the T is equal to delta H over delta S. And so we then plug in our values. We have 135.5 kilojoules. We must be careful here because one is given in kilojoules, the other is given in joules. So we probably should take our delta S and convert this to kilojoules, in which case we've got 1 kilojoule for every 1,000 joules. And so that's going to be a 0.3378 kilojoules per Kelvin. 0.3378 kilojoules per Kelvin. Kilojoules are then going to cancel out. We'll take the 135.5, divide it by the 0.3378, and we'll wind up with a temperature of 401.1 kelvins. And of course, then in degrees Celsius, if we really wanted the temperature in degrees Celsius, we'd subtract 273. The answer here was not specified. If it comes to a problem on D2L or an exam, I would specify the temperature. But it looks like this would wind up giving us a temperature of 128 degrees Celsius. So if you ever want to make CO2, all you need to do is take some baking soda, heat it up to 128K, and you'll wind up forming some CO2. Yes, sir?
I have a problem. Who does something?
And what is your problem?
Zero is a spontaneous.
That is correct. But when it changes over from being a spontaneous process, a non-spontaneous to spontaneous process, the place at which that happens is where it is one that is more at equilibrium. And equilibrium is one of those things that changes depending upon temperature. And for this particular reaction, if we have to heat it, this process is one that is endothermic. which we've seen here, that is endothermic. That is, we apply heat on this side here. And heat then is going to be one that winds up shifting it in the other direction over here. And so where we may have begin with all reactants, which is exactly what it is, by heating it up, then we're driving it over to products. And so at that point then, where it's reactant favored at the beginning, it is then going to become product favored. And the point at which it transitions over from reactant favored to product favored is going to be one that is equilibrium conditions, which is that value of zero. And so that's exactly where spontaneous and non-spontaneous transitions over, is at a delta G value of zero. Yeah. These units?
Yeah,
that's some defect on the monitor, just like this little, I'm not sure where the shadow shows up. I know it's annoying, but we have asked to have it addressed. Okay, anybody else? All right, that pretty much takes us through chapter 19. Two left. Yeehaw. Chapter 20 is actually going to start with a very quick review of chapter 4. And this is where the handout comes into play. By the way, I had an email from one of my colleagues today. I know it's kind of late to ask this, but I am curious how many have used the videos that I've posted to the notes page. Have any of you used them in here? 1, 2, 3, 4, okay, 7, 8. Would any of you use MP3s if I were to put up MP3s instead? MP3s would be like a podcast, and so you went to the videos? Okay. Well,
I mean, it's nice to have it.
Right. And I realize it in the summer, but, you know, it would be one of those backpack solutions then if you wanted to put it in your backpack. You could do that. So, okay. Okay, I'll try that then, and we'll see what happens. I'll leave the videos up there as well, but I'll see if I can't get one of those up. All right. Page 147 is where we're going to turn. Page 147. Or you can also refer to the handout here that we have. And so what we're going to do is we're going to look at assigning some oxidation numbers. And assigning oxidation numbers is going to be crucial to our understanding of electrochemistry. So we're going to see the redox handout. Now this should be a review for you. Even though it is a review, it's going to be one of those things that is so important that I do like to spend a little bit of time with this to make sure that we have this all done correctly. And so what I'm going to do here is I'm going to pull up a quick PowerPoint slides which I posted for today's lecture, which it matches the handout that you have here. And, oh, how do I go to present on the PowerPoint 2007? Slideshow? There we go, from the beginning. Now, assigning oxidation numbers. The rules of oxidation numbers here on page 147 are very straightforward, and they should make total sense. And that is, the oxidation number of any element that is a neutral element is going to be assigned a value of zero. The oxidation number of an atom in a monoatomic ion is going to be equal to the charge on the ion. Now, the main difference between oxidation numbers and charges is that when we want to show a charge on the ion, the sign is placed where? The back end. When we talk about oxidation numbers, we place the sign on the front end. So if we talk about the chloride ion,
we would say that the chloride ion has an oxidation number of negative 1. And the oxidation number on the sodium ion would be plus 1.
Then, if we look at the oxidation number of oxygen,
oxidation number of oxygen is going to be negative 2 in most of its compounds. One exception here is going to be peroxides,
and we'd find that as an oxidation number of negative 1. Then for hydrogen,
hydrogen's oxidation number is going to be assigned to positive 1 in most compounds. Exception will be the hydrides where it's negative 1.
The place where people have the most problem is with rule number 5,
just because of the wording, and this one's probably going to be easiest to look at by example. But we say that the oxidation number of fluorine is negative 1 in all of its compounds,
and that each of the halogens also has an oxidation number of negative 1 in its compounds, except for when we have a case when the halogen is above it, when we have another halogen above it in the periodic table, or if the other element is oxygen. In which case, if we have an element above it in the periodic table, or we have oxygen, all we do is we assign oxidation numbers to those higher elements first, or the oxygen first, before we assign it to the halogen. And then this rule then should also make sense, is that the sum of the oxidation numbers in a compound will sum to be 0. And if we have a polyatomic ion, the sum of the oxidation numbers in a polyatomic ion is going to equal the charge on the ion. So what we're going to do here, I know I realize we went through that fast, but again, they should all be ones that make sense. If you're going to memorize something, you probably ought to memorize rules 3, 4, and 5, because the other ones make sense. And even 2 and 3, or 3 and 4 make sense, because oxygen being in group 16 on the periodic table, oh yeah, that makes sense, it's negative 2. Hydrogen, of course, in group 1, oh yeah, that should make sense, because that there is in group 1. So probably the one you want to focus on most is probably rule 5, is the one that gives people the most fits. Well, what we're going to do then is we're going to look at the examples that are given here. On the flip side, we want to determine oxidation numbers for each element in the following species. And they are going to be K2SO4, H3PO4, we've got the dichromate ion, Cr2O7, 2 negative charge, and then we have Br2. And I think I'm going to add one more on so you get to practice your rule number 5. We'll have one that is BrCl3. So we'll add this one on. Well, let's apply those rules for the oxidation numbers. We'll start with the potassium sulfate. Starting with the potassium sulfate, assign an oxidation number first for the potassium. Potassium, of course, is a monoatomic ion, and so its charge is going to be 1 positive, so we'd write its oxidation number as plus 1. For oxygen, if it's in a compound, it's always going to be assigned an oxidation number of negative 2, unless it's a peroxide, in which case it's equal to negative 1. Well, then we have to assign the value of the oxidation number for sulfur. Remembering, of course, that the sum of the oxidation numbers in a compound must sum to yield 0. And so the important thing to remember here is that it's not the collective oxidation number of potassium is plus 1, but each of the potassium atoms in here has an oxidation number of plus 1. And so we want to assign the value for sulfur. We have 2 of them at a positive 1. We have 4 of them at a negative 2. So we have a positive 2 minus 8 is going to give us negative 6. And so if these two sum to give negative 6, that must mean the sulfur is equal to
positive 6
in order for the values to sum to yield 0. Let's have you then go through the remaining 4 and assign the oxidation numbers for each of the elements given in the formulas. Okay, looking at the phosphoric acid. Hydrogen gets assigned, plus 1. Next element we should assign would be oxygen, which would be negative 2. Positive 3 minus 8 is going to give us negative 5, which means phosphorus would be positive 5. Let's go to the Br2. Oxidation number of bromine in this case is 0. We have an element, and so as an element, it's assigned a value of 0, because the sum of it, 2 times 0, gives us 0. Then we go to BrCl3. One of these two, the bromine or the chlorine, is going to be assigned a negative 1. Which one gets assigned a negative 1? Chlorine does. We take the one that's lowest on the periodic table, and we assign that to negative 1. Now, if this is negative 1, that means bromine is? Plus 3. And finally, we go with the dichromate ion. Assign the oxygen first, which is? Negative 2. And so now we have 7 of those in the negative 2, which gives us a total of? Negative 14. And the sum of these two has to yield negative 2. And so what number plus negative 14 yields a negative 2? That would be a positive 12. But now that 12 has to be distributed over two atoms, so we get assigned a value of plus 6. And so these here are the oxidation numbers on the each of the atoms in the dichromate ion.
Two negative.
The oxidation numbers
are assigned with signs in front of the oxidation numbers. Charges on the ions have the sign after the numbers.
Okay. Would like to ask tomorrow. We do have a group that is going to be, and this was arranged. If you're wondering why I would not make other exceptions, this was something that was arranged about 4 months ago. But there is a group that is going to be giving their presentation on their lab project tomorrow at around 1:15. It'll be after the lab is done. If you are interested in sitting in and looking at that, watching that project and evaluating it, you're more than welcome to come in. It will give you an idea how to prep for your presentation next week. So we do have the one group with Nicole, Zach, and Rhonda. That will be coming in tomorrow at 1:15 to present it. You're welcome to stick around and join us.